Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
So one possible sign of peak inflation includes the spot rate for shipping containers, which tells us more about expenses that we can expect later in the pipeline for, say, apparel in Chicago, luxury items in Singapore, or home furnishings in Europe. And that index has declined 26% since its September 2021 all-time high. And so we've got some thoughts, bigger, broader, when it comes to what's happening in our shipping lanes.
Really pleased to have with us Daron Acemoglu, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Professor Acemoglu joining us via Zoom from Boston. Daron, great to have you with us. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, we wanted to talk to you because you've studied automation and AI, especially in the context of what's going on with supply constraints at the ports. And when we talk supply constraints, we talk about labor and we talk about personnel, of course, in other areas too. So to what extent can we expect in the near future AI to replace people and help alleviate some of this pain?
Well, you know, automation has been going on for at least 250 years since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And digital technologies have accelerated some of that trend. But, you know, we should not expect AI to start doing all sorts of jobs that we are used to. It's going to be a marginal process, but it will still be painful for some workers. You know, you're talking about dock workers, you know, some of the most iconic automation experiences of the last 60, 70 years. You know, with the containers coming in and, you know, much more mechanized forms of transport work have impacted the dock workers. You know, sometimes automation works out okay for not just for capital, but also for labor. There are examples of that from the West Coast, for example. But oftentimes you have to watch out that, you know, people who lose their jobs are not really thrown into poverty. I think that's one of the issues that we have to think about in the longer term. But in the short run, I think right now, as you started your segment, you know, we are facing a lot of supply chain disruptions, lots of shortages. So more mechanized production may be some of the solution.
You know, Daron, as you said, we've been living with automation for a long time, man and machine trying to figure it out. What's their way forward? We've talked about it with AI, how that can help a venture capitalist look at a lot more deals and smaller deals that they might not spend the time on because it's not worth their effort, but AI can help them filter through, or machine learning. Same thing with doctors, that can help screen patients, that gives them a broader view of being able to kind of handle patients. So I do wonder, how do we need to be smarter about what is the conversation between man and machine going forward, where automation actually helps us? It isn't just about replacing humans in the workforce.
I love how you put it, you know, at the beginning. your examples are all about what I would call machine usefulness. They are instances in which machines, in the majority of the cases you mentioned, digital machines, that have been designed to be useful to doctors, to paralegals, to finance professionals. We see also some of that taking place in the developing world. For example, completely transformative digital technologies that have helped some of the poorest countries in the world. I think that is actually the right model for moving forward. Find ways of using digital technologies, including machine learning and abundant data that now many companies have access to, in a way that's going to be useful to people. But that's not always the same as automation. It will involve some automation, but if we become too obsessed with automation, that may not actually satisfy the machine usefulness principle. We may do it when it's actually not helping humans, and we may actually overdo it. So I think that's the balance that we have to hit. I think when it comes to, you know, introducing heavy machinery to help with physical tasks, you know, I think we have to do that. There's no way out of that. Well, but at the same time, can we do it in such a way that we make these workers more productive?
I recently, a month or two ago, had a conversation with the CFO and the CEO of Chipotle, and the CEO of Chipotle saying, you know, when we're talking about automation, that, you know, maybe it would be great to have an something that could go through avocados. They go through so many in a given day. It's fresh, and they have a certain mission that, you know, there are things you can kind of take away from humans and let them do maybe higher skilled jobs, maybe even make more wages as a result.
Absolutely. When that works, that's great. But just taking away jobs from, you know, low-skill workers without providing them with new opportunities isn't the solution. I think that's what we have to bear in mind. For every automation effort, we should also ask, well, what can we do now for these workers who are losing their jobs? And a lot of that answer is technological and training-based. It's just we have to keep that in mind.
Daron, before we let you go, just in the last minute that we have with you, for our investing audience, what are some of the companies that they should keep an eye on that are operating in this space? And I know you're an academic, but you've written a lot about this.
I think there's a lot of new energy coming in the tech world when people are looking at the problems differently. Look at the health space or education space. The easiest thing, I think many of the large companies have already done those or started doing them, collect a lot of data and then find automated grading ways or automated teaching methods. But how can we, for example, provide better tools to teachers so that they can personalize education, they can identify the problems, the bottlenecks that their students are facing? How can we provide more empowering tools to nurses, essentially at a time when we have nursing shortages? I think there are a few companies working on this. I think we need more energy in those spaces. And in some sense, greater competitiveness in the tech sector would help. It's hard to do these sorts of things. I think that's what you were hinting at as well, when a few companies are dominating everything. So more startups, more sort of entrepreneurship in this space would be really helpful.
Daron, hopefully you can come back because this is an important conversation of our time, and I think we need to have a better understanding. And I think there, you know, workers certainly have some concerns that are out there. Our thanks to Daron Acemoglu. He is professor of economics at MIT, also author of numerous books, including in 2019, The Narrow Corridor, State Societies, and the Fate of Liberty, joining us via Zoom from Boston.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
A new issue of Bloomberg Business Week going to be out on newsstands later on this week. And this next story, already on the Bloomberg, can be found at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's about one of the big stories of the past week, the departure of one of the highest profile individuals in Silicon Valley. We're talking about Sheryl Sandberg, now former CEO of Meta Platforms.
Former, yeah. That's, you know,
weird,
she was there,
right?
For 14 years. Yeah. The story written by Max Chafkin, features editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Max, also the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio as well. As I mentioned, a full house in here, Joel. So funny last week.
All right, doesn't Tim sound funny, everybody?
It's a sultry voice, yeah.
thank you.
You just got to get that out of the way.
Yeah, it's still happening. It was funny last week when Sheryl Sandberg's sort of, you know, I guess we could call it an outgoing message, said that before she met Mark Zuckerberg, she didn't really know what the internet was.
A little ironic. She worked for Google before that.
Yeah, people gave her a lot of flack about that on Twitter, at least.
You know, more than anyone else, I think Sheryl Sandberg, as Max writes in this story, which we'll talk with him about, really found a way to monetize that internet that she didn't understand. And that came down to ads and what she was good at, first at Google and then probably better than anybody else in the history of advertising, was this thing that she conquered at Facebook. And it basically made digital advertising this the force that it became and that has dominated Facebook and has generated, you know, billions of, upon billions of dollars for a select few companies. So Max, what really stands out to you here? Because now we're, you know, a couple days off of that first wave of news of her departure, but really, like, as you write here, like, there's a bigger legacy
that
you can absolutely draw a line to Sheryl with.
Yeah. And I think that she probably deserves credit. Maybe it's shared credit, but as much as anybody else with sort of, constructing the internet as it exists today, which is this giant advertising machine where it collects, you know, enormous amounts of data, primarily through a handful of big companies, Meta, which is Facebook, of course, Alphabet, Google, Amazon, Apple, and so on, and uses that to create these personalized ads, which then, you know, pay for, you know, a whole range of businesses. It's really, as we wrote in the story, you know, kind of the scaffolding of the modern internet. And what's kind of interesting about Sheryl Sandberg is that the thing that made her famous, her greatest achievement in business, the thing that, you know, under maybe different circumstances would be setting her up for a run in politics or maybe a CEO job at another company, which certainly may happen, but it's gotten a lot more complicated where all of a sudden we have people, including Facebook, really, asking whether this was such a good thing. Maybe we don't want to live in a world where all our day is getting gobbled up by a handful of big companies and served back to us in the form of advertising.
Does this make her good or bad? We're thinking about her legacy. There's been a lot of thought about this, but she took this company that really needed to pivot. We talked about this with Joel last week, right after the IPO, right, where it stumbled out of the gate and then figured out how for this company to ramp up and make a ton of money.
Right.
Quickly.
Yeah, and that was what was so weird about this kind of weird attempt to rewrite history in this outgoing post, because the thing she did at Google was, you know, obviously internet companies have been selling ads, but Sheryl Sandberg's big achievement was saying to every small business owner, every business in America, you need to be on the internet. You need to be advertising on the internet. This is the way you're going to find customers. And it's like exactly what she built for Mark Zuckerberg. And I think when you take a few steps back from this, first of all, I think it's very easy to say, oh, Sheryl Sandberg's career is over. We should be doing a retrospective. I don't think that's likely. She's going to get – she probably already has other job offers. I also think there's a very good chance of a political run, even though, yes, it's very complicated. Yes, you know, a lot of people don't like Facebook. It's very controversial.
She and Matthew McConaughey can do it together.
But, you know, she's got a lot of name recognition. She has, you know, people forget, but she started her career in the Clinton White House, you know, working for Larry Summers. She's got a lot of political experience, you know, an amazing donor network. And, of course, she's, you know, one of the best known, you know, tech executives in the world. So for all those reasons, I don't think she's done. But I do think it's going to be complicated going from here.
But in speaking of complicated, it does also come at a time where Meta – is now called Meta, not Facebook anymore. It's completely shifted in the sense of not away from ads, but it does see the area of growth being this thing that is the metaverse. So in a sense, is that era of self-service ads, is that era of growth over, as you have, you know, Google controlling a big part of the market, YouTube owned by Google.
And Apple pushing back.
Exactly.
I mean, Apple really put a dent in Facebook's ability to generate income.
So no one knows. And I think that the part of the reason Sheryl Sandberg is leaving Facebook right now is because, as you said, Meta is moving away from the thing that she knows really well. The thing that she really knows well is selling advertising. And the plan, if you listen to Mark Zuckerberg, is to move away from that. Now, I think there are reasons to be skeptical of that. You know, Apple, of course, is imposing all of these, you know, privacy rules, and Facebook, Meta, has said that that's going to impact the company's revenue. We haven't really seen it impact Google's revenue quite as much. And I also think, just because they impose these new standards doesn't mean digital advertising is going away. It doesn't even mean that personalized, data-driven advertising is going away. What's going to happen, and it's already happening, is that the data will be increasingly collected on these platforms. So Apple won't let Facebook collect data on the iPhone, but Apple will certainly collect data about all of us on the iPhone. Facebook, meanwhile, can collect data in all the apps it controls and so on.
Max, you know, we read about how AdWords and AdSense was, you know, Google's flagship products, and that Sheryl had an involvement in creating those. I'm curious, what do you think the bigger, historically, what will be the bigger accomplishment? That effort at Google or what she accomplished at Facebook?
I mean, it's very hard because both of those efforts are extremely important and consequential. I think the Facebook thing, at least at the moment, feels like the bigger change because it took this. You know, Google was using search data, and search data, you're telling Google what you want. Google is looking at what you're telling it and spitting back something at you. The machine that Facebook has built and that Sheryl Sandberg, you know, was instrumental in building is really about looking at all this stuff you're doing on the internet, looking at who you're friends with, and kind of trying to read your mind. And that's less direct than I think what Google was doing, and that's why it kind of feels creepier. And it's that kind of creepy mind reading ability that I think is very much, you know, her legacy and is just a feature of the internet, for better or worse.
Except for when it serves me ads of something I've already bought. That's always like, it's like, come on, I did it already. You won.
I kind of like that when they do that. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, you're not that smart, are you?
And hence why you just keep buying stuff.
Well done, well done. Anyway, check out the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It'll be out later this week. This story, though, already on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. Our thanks to Businessweek editor Jill Weber and, of course, to Max Chafkin, features editor at Businessweek.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses like yours effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So Target tanks and shares of Kohl's kick up, a tale of two retailers. Covering it all is our own Bloomberg Intelligence senior retail staples and packaged food analyst, Jen Bartoshis. Tim, she joins us via Zoom from our Princeton, New Jersey bureau.
Jen, good to have you with us. I want to start with Target because we are seeing shares lower by about 3% off of their lows from earlier today. This after the company cut its guidance for a second time in just a few weeks. Why did things change so quickly for Target?
Well, I think really this is an execution issue. And when you think about it, when we had the earnings a couple of weeks ago, I think that they thought they would have more time to sell through that inventory. And somewhere in this span of 3 weeks, they've really decided to just cut it and get it done. And it's likely because they're starting to look forward to the back to school season, the holiday season, and they want to make sure that they're going into those with really a clean slate and are well prepared.
You know, Jen, it's funny. Paul Sweeney earlier on radio said, well, wait, isn't this what retail is all about, that they're supposed to be experts in managing inventory? Having said that, we're in a really strange environment that I think a lot of retailers have tried to order extra to make sure they don't run out because of the supply chain problem. So how do we think about what Target is saying with that kind of backdrop?
Well, I think that there are still certain categories where retailers will continue to make sure that they are well stocked, whether that's on the grocery side, whether that's on some of the more essential side in terms of paper goods. But when you're talking about more discretionary items, that's really, those are really the areas that we're talking about now. We're seeing that consumer spending is pulling back, the savings rate is falling. That means that for categories like apparel or electronics, and even to a certain degree, sporting goods, these are areas where consumers are now saying, you know what, I think I'm good. And so there's this excess inventory that's been built up that now they really need to try to get rid of. And don't forget, we had a really cold spring. And so there's a lot of apparel that didn't sell. And now they're trying to make up for that as well.
So it's not a case of them missing a trend. It's a case of just having too much stuff on hand. And not the demand.
Exactly. It really is. And it's, you know, Target is actually quite good at trends, mm-hmm. right? That's part of why they have such a loyal following from their customers. But the other aspect to all this inventory conversation is, you know, don't forget that when they talk about the cost of inventory, there's inflation baked into that to a certain degree as well. So they may not have an absolute larger number of physical items on hand, but the value of those items has changed because of inflation. There's also that part of the calculation that doesn't always get brought up into the conversation that you can't forget about as well.
That's a really smart point.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because I'm wondering about how we can read into broader economic consequences, or not even consequences, but you know, the tea leaves about the broader economy just by looking at what Target is saying, because in a sense, this is deflationary, right?
Well, this is really a choice by the retailer to liquidate overstocks that they have on hand. You know, the options you have are to either try to sell through it slowly or to try to just liquidate it quickly. And it sounds like Target has come to the conclusion that they want to try to just get it off their books quickly. Whether other retailers are going to be in a similar circumstance is really coming down to the type of retailer they are and what their individual strategy is dictating. You know, we saw really mixed results through the earnings cycle that we just went through with regards to different types of retailers flourishing or struggling in the current economic environment. And I think that general overarching trend is something that we're just going to be continuing to see as we head into, you know, the latter half of this year.
And Jen, as you point out, though, I mean, Target, what they're saying is murkier because they did maintain their sales guidance for the year, right? So it's not
exactly,
it's nuanced. I think as you write, there's a story on the Bloomberg and they quote you. This is a nuanced report from what we got from Target.
It is. And you know, when you think about it, people are still buying things, and they, you know, it's just that it's about what they're choosing to buy, mm-hmm. And how much of inflation is playing into the actual basket costs of what they're buying. So the top line, you know, there's a reason that they haven't changed that. And, you know, part of that is supported by inflation and just prices naturally rising. But part of it is just that there is a shift in product mix of where people are spending their money. And that, you know, Target has one of the strengths of their business is that they have multiple categories.
Yep.
And so they have the ability to shift as well. But at this juncture, they're a little bit behind that shift. And so now they're trying to make up that ground and reset as we head into the second half of the year.
Hey, Jennifer, just we have 30 seconds left. Got to get your comment on Kohl's up 10% after saying it's in an exclusive talks about a potential $8 billion takeover from Franchise Group. That's the owner of Pet Supplies Plus and The Vitamin Shoppe. Your take?
Well, obviously, there's been a lot of interest in terms of an outside buyer for Kohl's. I think that clearly investors are you know, indicating that they see a good opportunity for the company to be taken over. But we'll have to see what happens during this period.
Do we still need a Kohl's, Jen?
Sure. You know, again, they have a lot of loyal fans, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really about, you know, who are the core customers and is that core customer still in the healthy spot to where they can support that kind of business?
Always love checking in with you. Jen Bartoshis, she is Senior Retail Staples and Packaged Food Analyst, breaking it down, the Target news, the Kohl news. We're following it all as she is. She is a part of our Bloomberg Intelligence team.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. As Tim mentioned earlier, we are seeing some buying into the close. So we are at our highs of the session, up about 1% on both the S&P and the NASDAQ, 0.8% higher on the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Eager to hear what our next guest has to think about it. Eric Clark is portfolio manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund. Eric joining us on the phone from San Diego. Eric, how are you?
I'm good, Tim. How are you?
Doing well. I imagine it's a beautiful day in sunny San Diego. Help us make sense of what's going on today, because the narrative today was, okay, bad numbers from Target, revising its profit outlook again for the second time in 3 weeks. We saw stocks slide, and now we're seeing some real buying into the close with the S&P 500 higher by a full percentage point. How do you make sense of it?
I think every day the market has a mind of its own. Sometimes it's a little oversold and in need of a little bounce, and sometimes it's a little overbought, and then shorts come in. And so, you know, we're in this locked in this trading range, over 37.50 on the S&P, and, you know, 20 at the bottom ends of the VIX, and, you know, who knows, at 40 plus on the upside of the VIX. And we're just chopping around until we get some more real data on if inflation can be contained and how the Fed is going to revolve around that. So micro is trumping micro in the fundamentals for
all now. Right. I want to get to what you've been doing in terms of buying or selling. Your fund, by the way, beating just about all of your peers over the past month, up nearly 3%, according to our data here at Bloomberg. Over the past 5 years, returning on average annually more than 12%, putting it in the 63rd percentile, according to our data. But the top holdings are household names. It's Blackstone, it's Apple, it's Tesla, it's Home Depot and Lowe's, Microsoft, Alphabet, KKR. That's as of the end of April. Have you been doing any buying and selling, Eric, amid the volatility of 2022?
We are a very active fund to begin with. So turnover tends to be higher because we like to trade around the core names that we love.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in times when the VIX is over 20, you know, trading opportunities are usually pretty much everywhere. And so if you can hold some cash, like right now we have about 11% cash, that's strictly to be used for short-term tactical trading. Could be in a name that we love that we already hold. Could be in a completely new name that we just see an opportunity. So
is that a high cash position for you, Eric? Based historically,
it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the fourth quarter of 18, when we were really nervous about the Fed doing what they're doing, you know, we were as high as 35%. But typically, we're 10% or less cash. And, you know, right now, until the market breaks that 37.50, which it certainly could, you know, anything's possible if earnings estimates start to roll over, or QT doesn't seem to be doing well because of the credit markets are seizing up. I mean, there's any number of things that could make us go up in cash. But for right now, we're just trying to trade around the core names that we love because the volatility is higher.
So what have you been buying? What have you been selling?
Well, we have trimmed some Tesla. You know, Elon loves to just, you know, he's so impulsive. I mean, the guy's clearly a genius, but he's
so impulsive.
He's not impulsive. Some of the things that he does. You know, so I, you know, this whole Twitter thing is a big distraction, and, you know, it may affect the stock price. So, you know, we've trimmed that one. I still love it. I'd love to buy it again, you know, down at 500. We've really been beefing up probably the biggest mega trend that I see, and it happens to be in our own industry, is this migration of money away from stocks and bonds because of a variety of reasons, but into alternatives, private equity, venture, mm-hmm. hedge funds, you know, those kinds of things. And, you know, Blackstone is kind of the Apple of the private equity business. KKR is the second largest. And this isn't your grandfather's private equity. So these guys have stable, predictable earnings between the two of them, about $1.5 trillion in assets. Blackstone yields over 4%. You know, they're just, you know, when you have a bunch of companies that have, you know, $200 billion in dry powder to take advantage of whatever chaos happens because of inflation, that gives you a really good comfort zone. And I know there's lots of talks about the venture side of it with markdowns. That's absolutely happening. You're going to see it with every private company, but they're not real focused on that part of the market. They're in infrastructure and real estate and rental houses and, you know, much more stable businesses. So I just love that industry, and it's pretty underowned in most portfolios. So that's about, gosh, 13 plus 6 or 7. So that's almost 20% of the fund just in KKR and Blackstone.
Wow.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, and because of what private equity does in an environment like this, but that was a good answer. I wonder about Costco and how you're thinking about Costco. It's interesting today. The company that was looked at as the online version of Costco Box, it's one of my decliners today because it's falling another 35% after falling yesterday. Why are you optimistic about Costco?
Well, they just seem to manage inventory better than anybody. I mean, this management team and how they pay their employees and the loyalty they have and the loyalty with the memberships, the mousetrap is just better than anybody else's. And, you know, the stock is never cheap. It's, you know, trading north of probably it's 30 times earnings or something. But in this kind of market where there's, you know, little mines everywhere on the field that you're playing, Costco's stability, their dividend growth, the growth outside of the U.S. is worthy of a premium. And so I'm much more comfortable, you know, adding to Costco. In fact, the day that Target got beat up the last time that when they reported their earnings and the stock was down like 35%, I didn't buy more Target. I bought a ton more Costco, and I have since traded out of that because it went straight down and then it went straight back up again. That's the kind of environment we're in. So in that category, I'm certainly concentrated in Costco because I just think they're better at managing inventory than Walmart and Target in particular. Although if Target goes down a little bit further, I'll probably get more engaged with Target again because demand is not the problem. It's just excess inventory and managing that supply demand or that's, you know, the supply chain, which has been really tough.
Yeah, interesting. I love having you on. We talk specific names, and I do love that you guys are active. So we really get a feel of kind of where you've been going over the last few months and gives us some insight for investors. Hey, Eric, thanks so much. Eric, of course, he is portfolio manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund. Eric Clark joining us on the phone from San Diego.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com. Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.